This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by RogerandChris.com.
I'm going to tell you something.
Yes?
It has been a 10-week-long love-in.
What a ride it's been.
With RogerandChris.com. Sometimes the ads were just you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes listeners just writing in unprovoked.
Yeah.
To say that they bought furniture for RogerandChris.com and they were like, let me tell you why I love it.
Yeah.
We had people compose
a jingle.
So listen, RogerandChris.com just got a whole bunch of good advertising out of us. And we got advertising money from them too. They did pay us,
that's
right?
That's how that works.
Okay, great. Usually, I do love getting paid. This is our last one.
Mm.
This is our 10th and final ad for RogerandChris.com.
For now, anyway.
Until they decide to re-up.
Yeah.
And it is appropriate, I think, that this final ad is another unsolicited testimonial.
Wow.
Wilson wrote in, and he says, after looking at a dozen chair styles and more than a dozen leather swatches, they arrived in just a couple of days after making my selection online. I finally made my decisions and put my money down on an order from Roger and Chris. They have been so cheerful every step of the way, and the very helpful personal emails from Chris were the icing, or maybe the gravy, whatever seasonal bonus food metaphor fits. I encourage your listeners to check out their website. At times, it may seem like you have too many choices, as they have so many styles and more than 1,300 swatches, again, from which you can select online, and they will mail samples to you for free. But the website makes navigating all the choices pretty easy. Also, there are plenty of photographs to help you get a feel for each piece. He says, I know this is not a gay bear podcast per se, but y'all be pretty bear and gay. I encourage your fans to check out the dozens of videos from Chris on the site as well. It's like OnlyFans, but for furniture. Thank you, Wilson. I'm sure Chris appreciates that.
No doubt.
Listen, you don't... I'm sorry, I put the mic for the music. You don't become a big bodybuilding guy.
Yes, and not want to have people notice.
I don't know that you want to have people notice, but people are going to notice.
Yes.
And that's just how it is.
Sure.
So, Chris made his bed. He knows. People are checking him out, going like, oh, look, that's a very large man.
Standing next to that really gorgeous chair.
Standing next to that really cool couch and chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, here's theme music.
Why not?
The love theme from Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
And if you are a very bad person and you decided you were going to fast forward through that final ad for RogerandChris.com, you go back and listen to it because that was gold. We are the masters of off-the-cuff, on-the-fly ad spots, if I do say so myself.
I would have to agree. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. We are film critics. You can find our work at The Wrap. You can hear me on other podcasts. I have a book out, which I'll mention later.
Several times.
Probably.
Yeah.
So anyway, welcome.
If you hear noises in the background, it's because we have an office assistant now.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. Currently making packagey things happen.
Yes.
Envelope-y bits, scissoring sticker items, and so many things.
Yes, we've needed one.
We have needed one.
It's exciting that it's happening.
Yes. There's cinema to discuss.
There is.
I almost feel guilty, and yet I don't, that we are talking about three movies today when the pileup of Christmas time releases is crushing us like an avalanche.
Yeah.
And sometime earlier this week, and I can't remember if I've already said this on the mic or not, but if I did, I'll just repeat myself. F all of this is really what I'm trying to get at here. I want to have a year of adult conversations about adult films that are made for adults, written by adults, directed by adults, for adults. Listen, I love the children's films as well.
Sure.
I'm going to go see whatever the new... is there a Thor movie coming up? There is, right? Like in early part of 2022?
The next one, I think, is Doctor Strange.
Sure. Okay, Doctor Strange. A children's film. That's coming in what, January?
May.
I will watch it happily. I know there's some Marvel or DC or Star Wars-y thing happening in January or February. Something is coming because you sent me...
Morbius, I think, in January.
You sent me the big, long...
The Batman in
the
March.
Grid. You sent me this giant grid of everything that's coming out in the next year. And I looked at that giant grid and I thought, I don't know what any of this is. But I will happily watch all of it. All right? Because, A, it's my job. B, I like a superhero-y, action-y, you know, pew-pew kind of thing.
A
with
mixed
the
diet.
Green screens and stuff like that. Yeah. But let me tell you something. Here's something I've learned in the past year. It's not good to eat cake twice a day. I mean, it is good.
But not good for you.
But it makes your body do crazy things that you probably don't want it to do. And I'm not even talking about getting fat, because that was already settled.
Yeah.
And beautifully so. But it is perhaps more to your benefit if you are not having cake two times a day.
The occasional salad.
So the children's films are cake. All right. And if you're offended that I'm calling them children's films, then you haven't listened very long to this podcast because
we cover the water.
Yes, we do.
I hate being a week away from everybody expecting my top 10 list. And I suddenly have all of these like
30 movies that are very important.
Yes. And most of them are foreign films and documentaries. And most of them are opening this month.
Yeah. Because they want award consideration,
right.
And they hope that
they
will be...
And they think that we'll forget about them if they open in August. They all have to come out in December because everybody wants to be the last film that you see before you vote. And I hate that.
Film critics are notorious goldfish. And they need to...
We've all got lists on Letterboxd. Come on. We remember things.
You know what? I don't.
I finally have one.
But isn't it just Hallmark Christmas movies?
No, I did one for all the new movies I saw this year as well.
Did you really?
Yes.
Okay.
Just so that when I get to sit down to make my list, I'll remember things.
Occasionally I try to make a list like as I go throughout the year, but what I wind up doing after Thanksgiving is going back through the podcasts and writing down the titles of what I really liked. Because we talk about everything we see over the course of a year. I can remember all the way back to This Is Not a Burial, It's a Resurrection. I can remember all the way back to the reissue of Where Does Your Hidden Smile Lie? Two of my favorite films of the year. Have you seen them yet? Well, they came out earlier in the year. You've had time.
Yeah, I think my year started with Shadow in the Cloud, that movie with Chloe Grace Moretz in the turret of a World War II plane and there's a monster. It was actually it was edited really well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't remember that at all. I know I didn't watch it.
You didn't see it. It was written by Max Landis, but directed by a woman and supremely well edited.
Okay. Maybe I'll look at it sometime soon. Hmm. Or maybe I won't. I don't like being pressured at the end of the year to watch a three dozen movies that everyone is telling me, oh, you simply must.
Before you
make your year-end list. Well, guess what? No one's paying me to make a year-end list. I'll make one for this podcast, and it'll come to y'all probably sometime in early January.
Yes.
Because that's when the year will be over.
It's amazing. I can't believe that Locked Down, a movie that most people did not care for nearly as much as I did.
Right.
The one with Chiwetel Ejiofor and Anne Hathaway.
Yes.
That was this year.
It was this year. came out very early in the year. It was streaming on
HBO Max.
One of the streamings. And I remember not hating it. It seemed like a fun little, you know, heist movie. Are you bringing it up because you think it's really great and you want people to talk about it or think about it?
It is a movie that I liked a lot. I don't know that it's going to make it to my top 10 necessarily. I just think of it as surely that movie came out in 2020. Oh, no, no. Right. 2021.
No. I went back and I looked at all the stuff.
Yeah.
On our, you know, that we talked about. Yeah. So what I'm trying to get at here is I want these films to be released all throughout the year.
Yes.
And not just in December for award consideration, because I don't have time to watch all of them. I have time from like one, maybe two films a day if I don't have 17 other tasks that I have to complete for a different podcast, for the running of this home, for the operation of this business. You hear those clickety-clackety noises in the back? This person is here at this table helping us because I don't have time to get everything accomplished in the year. I sound angrier than I am. I am not angry.
Okay.
But I am...
frustrated.
I am passionate about not being bothered at the end of the year by a million movies that suddenly are the most urgent and the most important and the most acclaimed thing that you'll see. Also, by the way, it's 3 hours long.
Always, yes.
Drive my car.
It's not really opening until January, but it's going to show up for a week in December for qualification, so you have to count it now.
In your city.
Yeah.
Which just means you happen to live in Los Angeles or New York.
Yes.
And we live in Los Angeles or New York.
Yeah.
So, you know...
I know, poor us, but we're
just catching. Well, I mean, not poor us. I'm not asking for sympathy. I'm just saying, give me work to do during the year that needs my mental engagement. That isn't, fluff that no one's going to talk about at award time anyway,
right?
Or that needs to be seen before you make your almighty year-end list. Which again, I will not be making.
Look, I am required by various folks.
I know you are.
So.
You're being paid to do so.
Given my druthers,
I ain't.
Not a priority.
We're finally catching up to the French Dispatch.
Yes, we are.
Because it was released into theaters only.
Mm-hmm.
When? September? October? Whenever that
Something
was.
Like that, yeah.
And that was, you know, when pre-booster. Delta variant was still knocking them down left and right.
Yeah.
And we said, you know what we're not going to do? We're not going to go to the movies to see The French Dispatch.
Or anything else.
And so we finally got a chance to look at it. Is it streaming now for the public? Or did we just get a screener? We got a year-end screener for award consideration.
Yes, we did.
And in order to catch up, we decided to start doing things that were a little older, that had been sitting around for a while.
Right.
But we did finally watch The French Dispatch, the latest film from Wes Anderson, who we are fans of. And we know at this point in history, it is not cool to be a fan of Wes Anderson. Everyone is tired of him now.
I suppose.
We're tired of people who are putting in the effort.
Yeah, we've reached saturation point, and apparently, not us we, but the general we, there is this idea that if filmmakers do something well over and over again, but it starts feeling too samey, then they don't get credit for it anymore. Like, every single movie has to be completely different and an utter reinvention and, you know, I don't know. He's definitely a target these days, it feels like.
My favorite band of all time is Sonic Youth.
Mm-hmm.
And from the time they started to the time they stopped, they made songs that started out like strummy, strummy guitar, strummy, strummy guitar, distorted guitar. Kim or Thurston comes in and sings or talks. Well, not respectively, because she talked, he sang. Then after a couple of verses, there'd be this breakdown where the guitars would be like, and then there'd be like a 20-minute freak out of noise. And then it would end quietly. And that is a Sonic Youth song. And do you know how many times they did that kind of song? Over and over and over and over again. And you know how many times I loved it? Every single melon farming time. Shout out to our dearly departed recent friend, James Rocky. He gave us Melon Farmer. Well, yes. He gave me Melon Farmer. So
He gave the world Melon Farmer. Is that our recent friend? He's our recently departed
friend. Our recently departed friend. Therefore, when I saw Bottle Rocket in the 90s at the AMC, whatever the hell it was in Dallas, the 24 screen.
The grand, right.
Before, I get tore it down already. It's not even there anymore. Yeah. They built it in the 90s. It was hot new. And now it's apparently completely gone.
Yeah.
From the moment I saw Bottle Rocket, I thought, I like this guy. What is this guy about? What's he doing? Everything seemed a little odd and a little off. And the way his characters spoke to each other seemed incredibly scripted, with just a tiny diminishment of human behavior. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah.
Like, they all talk like they are reading from the same book.
I remember when Hal Hartley became a thing in the 90s.
Yes.
His comedic style being described as Buster Keaton via Jean-Luc Godard.
Yeah.
And I think that Wes Anderson maybe takes that a step further. Right. In that the performances are as stylized as the sets and the,
yes,
you know, everything, the fonts, you know,
yeah.
And that there is a remove of behavior in how they speak and address each other.
And even though there is that remove, he can still move you.
Yes.
Because his people still are people doing people things.
And they can break your heart.
That you recognize, and they can break your heart, even if they're making you laugh while they do it. And so as his films became more and more intricate and elaborate and about the sets and the composition and the text appearing on screen describing this or that thing, and the absolute idiosyncrasies of every single human being that you see on screen, even if they don't have dialogue.
Especially if they don't have dialogue sometimes.
I have grown to love him more and more. I think the stop-motion dog movie might have been my least favorite.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm even blanking.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Isle
of Dogs.
Isle of Dogs.
That is my least favorite, I think. Yes,
but
agree.
In general, I've loved everything he does. People who create their own specialized worlds, mm-hmm, and who set their characters in those worlds and like spin them like tops.
Yeah.
I adore that. It's one of the reasons that I love watching those old Ernst Lubitsch movies with you when they're on TCM on a Saturday night, and we're like, hey, let's just sit down and watch this. It's one of the reasons why I have always loved what Amy Sherman Palladino does. Mm. Because and she works in television, but from TV series to TV series, nothing changes. The set may be a different setting.
Right.
But her characters speak the way she speaks, and I know they speak the way she speaks because I've heard her speak in public settings before. Yes. She's a mile a minute. She's referencing a million things at once. She is, I assume, I've never met her, that she's a complete megalomaniac, and I'm grateful for that. And I assume the same thing about Wes Anderson.
Yeah, Wes Anderson, you imagine that there's
as long as they're benevolently, you know,
yeah,
that
of course,
way.
But there's not a shoelace or a hem or a paperclip on that set that he hasn't like personally put into place,
right,
and like thought about. I the movies of his that I love,
yeah,
I don't love all of them. I Darjeeling Limited and Steve Zissou, not my favorites. Mm-hmm. But when he is firing on all cylinders, I can completely indulge in the art direction of it all and feel things. Like we recently rewatched Rushmore for breakfast all day.
Yeah.
And that movie still makes me cry.
Yeah.
And not in, even necessarily the places you expected it would. It just, it has, there is so much emotion and so much humanity amidst the filigree, amidst the symmetry and the futura fonts and all the stuff that he does, you know.
Yeah.
The French Dispatch.
is everything at once.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I don't think I like your tone.
Here's the thing. As an object, it is the ultimate Wes Anderson experience.
Okay.
I cared the least about everyone and anyone in it.
After about 20 minutes, I thought, okay, so I'm not going to have emotions about what is happening with any of these folks. Mm-hmm. But it is such a loving recreation of a world that is gone now.
Right.
That he clearly has, you know, affection for. So I felt that affection and I felt that warmth, even though, no, there was no one on screen because there are 85 actors in this film and each of them has a cumulative 6 minutes of screen time. So there's no time to feel for anybody that what anyone's going through. But there is time to experience his love of this old magazine.
Well, sure,
this is a film about an old magazine.
This is my parents subscribed to the New Yorker, the movie.
Right. Yes.
And I think maybe that's part of what kept me at a remove from the characters. Mm. Because this isn't just like an anthology film, but a series of vignettes, basically.
Right.
But it's a series of vignettes that are in them that are themselves presented as magazine articles.
Yes.
So it's just like one layer of division after another before it's like, it's like you're watching the recording of an audiobook. You know, that's how divorced you are from the idea of these being actual characters.
I don't care about that.
Okay.
What I cared about was the whole. And the whole is it is the story is that there is a magazine editor played by Bill Murray, and he cares only about the well-being of his writers.
How we know it's fiction.
I've had some good editors in my life. But even they had to answer to people who did not give one dang about me. And so, I've never had an experience like the kind of experience that this editor is giving to his writers. This just carte blanche, you know, way of living.
Yeah. He's William Shawn, basically.
Yeah. So there are three separate stories that we are presented in The French Dispatch. The Concrete Masterpiece. These are the names of the stories.
Yeah.
The Concrete Masterpiece, which is about an artist in prison. Revisions to a Manifesto, which is about young revolutionaries, and The Private Dining Room of the Police Commissioner, which is about a chef. In the midst of it all, there is a cycling reporter played by Owen Wilson. He does nothing but ride a bicycle around pointing out things.
Paris. Is that the fourth story, maybe?
Kinda, but you know.
It's not Paris, it's ennui.
On
malaise or something.
What is it? Goofy made up stuff. The cast is Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton, Lea Seydoux, Frances McDormand, Timothy Chalamet, Lena Kudrow, Jeffrey Wright, Matthew Amalric, Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, and then like 30 other people.
Jason Schwartzman.
Did I say Elizabeth Moss? She's
Elizabeth
in here
Moss,
too.
Yeah.
So what you get is, like I was saying earlier, a cumulative effect of too much of everything at once.
There's a reason why people's New Yorkers stacked up by the sofa.
Yeah, there is, because you looked at each article. I remember we subscribed to the New Yorker for like a year. This is when we first moved here.
Uh-huh.
And they stacked up because you didn't have time to read all the articles, and all the articles seemed cool. And then, of course, now I read it online. But that era of U.S. history, U.S. cultural history, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, it is the era to which Wes Anderson is the most devoted in terms of cultural output, and most devoted in terms of how everything looked.
I was saying graphic design and design.
So it's...
This is a manual typewriter movie.
Well, all of his movies are manual typewriter movies, but this is the most typewriter movie of all his movies.
Yeah.
As we watched it, I found myself, if I was frustrated by any one thing, it was that I would look at a shot, admire this beautiful composition, and then it was gone in 5 to 15 seconds. On to the next one.
Yeah.
What I need is like a 3-hour documentary about every set, the army of people who were clearly brought in to create these physical environments.
It's like watching a slideshow being conducted by someone who's had too much coffee.
Yes.
You're like, wait, I didn't get that. What was the, you know, yeah. We talked about, we're going to watch this again, and we're just going to keep
freeze framing. Yeah, so we can look at stuff.
Yeah.
I love this. And yeah, is it about anything right now? If it is about something right now, and I think it is.
The death of print media and what that means?
It's about the diminishment of intellectual life.
Yes.
It's in the same way that it's not cool to like Wes Anderson anymore. It's you are a pretentious snob if you care about the stuff this movie cares about. If you care about the stuff that those old issues of the New Yorker cared about. And yeah, it's a very specific window, right? It's not inclusive or expansive. It is a culture of mostly whiteness.
Yeah. Although Jeffrey Wright does play a very James Baldwin-esque character.
That is correct. But within that context, that was the best of what you could get, you know, from those folks, from all those white folks. If you wanted the smartest white people, that's where you went.
Right.
It didn't offer you everything you needed if you were going to be a citizen of the world or a well-rounded, well-read person. But what it did offer you was good stuff.
You know, we talk a lot about the idea of culture in this country, and that people at least used to feel the need to fake it. You know,
explain what you mean.
I mean, there was a period after World War II where people felt like they needed to have at least a passing reference point to the current best-selling novels, say.
Okay.
Even if that meant reading the Reader's Digest condensed version,
right,
or joining the Book of the Month Club and letting those stack up the way the copies of the New Yorker stacked up. But there was at least a notion of a shared cultural literacy that people should be... Like, you watch old game shows, and people will make Shakespeare references that you would never make on TV now.
Okay.
There's this understanding of like a baseline of, you know, we have to pretend to like opera. We have to pretend to like
Shakespeare. Well, that's why they used to show operas on television.
Exactly.
Like on network television.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then at some point it was like we just stopped even caring to like even... In fact, it went full the opposite, where if you genuinely do like that stuff and you talk about it publicly, then who do you think you are?
People are going to goof on you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know, the people who were left out of that conversation back then were obviously people of color, women, queer people, sure. For the most part.
Yes.
Some made it through.
Yes.
Into the mainstream white, you know, discourse of the time. And so in many ways, the world is better now because you get to hear from more and more people who were excluded.
So I think the difference is that, you know, yes, the canon has been expanded.
Yes.
And the voices in the culture who talk about literature have been expanded.
Yes.
But they are being addressed at a general populace who has stopped reading everything.
Right. They don't even care about the old dead white guys anymore.
Yeah, they don't read SWAT.
Yeah.
So it's okay. Like, yeah. So you're more likely to find an article in The Atlantic about, you know, Audre Lorde or whatever, but it's going to be read by a tenth of as many people who would have read it
right.
40 years ago or
right.
60 years ago.
Listen. My brain just went completely blank and I forgot what I was going to say. So,
I loved looking at this.
Yes.
I'm glad I saw it.
Yes.
But
I'm going to see it again.
But yeah, I will look at it again just because there's so much to look at. But I do prefer a Wes Anderson movie that also makes me feel things.
Okay. I'll allow that from you.
Thank you.
I prefer being delighted visually.
Why not both?
Sometimes you can only have one.
Fair enough.
I love this movie.
All right.
Be looking at this again.
This episode of Linoleum Knife is also brought to you by Film Movement Plus, a streaming service for fans of independent film. It opens a world of award-winning entertainment, including some of the best movies from prestigious festivals around the globe. Among the hundreds of titles waiting for you to discover are acclaimed films you won't find anywhere else, plus newly restored classics, award-winning shorts, new films added every week. It's available on all your favorite devices, including Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire. Film Movement Plus is priced at a very, very reasonable $5.99 a month. But wait! Linoleum Knife listeners can get a 14-day free trial plus 50% off their first 3 paid months using the promo code KNIFE, K-N-I-F-E. Sign up today at filmmovementplus.com and use that promo code KNIFE.
That went Ronco real fast.
Now how much would you pay?
You are, I'll tell you something, when you do an ad, you do an ad. You are like... You become like, what have they won, Johnny? Like
it's, they didn't pay for a song. They paid for an ad.
You're right. They got one just now. Film Movement Plus is very nice.
It is.
Lots of movies, very good movies.
And truly stuff you're not going to find streaming anywhere
That's
else.
Also correct.
Yeah.
We watched Benedetta.
Yeah, we did.
It is the new film from Paul Verhoeven. Currently, we have people from the Catholic League outside our front door protesting the fact that we're going to talk about it. Is that what they're called? The Catholic League?
The Catholic League, yeah.
Bunch of wackos. This is a film that is based on a real person.
Yeah.
A 17th century nun who had visions and who... was also involved in a lesbian relationship with another nun. And all the troubles that befell them because of these two things. Mostly befell her.
Yes. Also, there was a plague going on.
It also did happen during the time of the plague. Makes things even more complicated.
Yes.
So, it stars Virginie Efira. As Benedetta, she is a devout child, and her parents, who are pretty wealthy, they deliver her to the convent when she's about 10. She has a little Blessed Virgin wooden
statue,
doll figure statue. She carries with her everywhere.
Even as a child, she seems very... connected to divinity in one way or another, and also is whip smart. Like, you know, as they're traveling to the convent, a band of marauders shows up, tries to steal the mother's necklace, and Benedetta basically talks them down.
Right. When she gets there, she meets the abbess, played by the great Charlotte Rampling.
Yes, who I think is playing the same character she plays in Dune.
Pretty much, yes. She also meets another, after she's been there about 10 years.
Yes.
She meets another young, what are they called, the novitiate?
Yes.
Okay.
Novice.
I know a couple of Catholic words. Mm. You're the expert.
Brr.
You were telling me what things meant with some frequency. Named Bartolomea, played by Daphne Patakia. And together, they begin having lots and lots of really cool sex.
Yes. And it's a Paul Verhoeven movie, so you know he is not shying away from that in any way.
Meanwhile, Benedetta's visions continue.
Yes.
And now, I don't know how connected this film is to the real life experiences or career trajectory of Benedetta. But in this film, there is always the question surrounding her of, did you really just have a vision, or are you running a game?
Yeah. Did you really, did stigmata spontaneously occur, or are you hacking at your palms and feet?
When you prayed at the statue, did it topple over on you because you did something to it, or did it really topple over on you?
Yeah.
Did you imagine, the spirit of the devil entering someone else in the convent and then begin speaking in this kind of voice to everybody to tell everybody that Satan is here? Or are you just, as I just said, running a game? The best game, by the way.
Sure.
If, in fact, she was Nomi Maloning her way to the top, she knew what she was doing in a really wickedly good way.
And yet, these very questions are the same questions of any person of faith. And,
yes.
And you know, of any, you know, of grappling with the idea of Jesus being human and divine, of,
yeah,
you know, the Holy Trinity and all the things that are tied into religion. You know, do you believe it or not? Is it a con or not? And so Verhoeven very shrewdly never tells us. Like, he keeps providing clues that maybe she's faking it, but maybe she's not. And weirdly, for as much as this movie is irritating the Catholic leagues of the world, this is a film about faith.
It is entirely a film about faith, because the way this character is portrayed by Virginie Efira is absolutely straightforward and serious. If anyone questions her, she looks at them, like cuts through them with her expression,
yeah,
and says, I'm in communion with God, and I don't know what you're even talking about.
Right.
She does, that's not a quote, but that's basically what she says to them.
Yeah.
How dare you speak to me in such a manner? I said good day. Like, it is that kind of, if you can't get with me and my visions, which are real and happening right now, then please step aside.
Yeah, how because dare you profess yourself to be...
I have business to attend to with my Lord and Savior.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there is some showgirls in here. There's some black book in here. There's a lot of women who are doing their best to survive in systems that are ultimately run by men.
Right.
You know, Nomi and Crystal may be facing off in Showgirls over who gets to star in Goddess, but it's ultimately the men who run the casino who wield the power over everybody.
Yes.
You know, who make these decisions, and like, which Nomi eventually has to lash out against when they affect her personally. You know, Black Book is about a woman doing whatever it takes to survive being a Jewish woman in Holland, right?
I believe.
During World War II, during the Nazi occupation, yeah. and not apologizing for any of it.
Right.
You know, and so these women, the convent itself is obviously, yes, it is a cloistered female world, but you've got bishops and you've got the, you know, I forget all the titles, but all these dudes who keep wanting to tell them what's what and how it's going to be.
Yes.
And, you know, who, to the way the Catholic Church is still structured, where women are excluded from the priesthood and, you know, all of the hierarchy of, you know, the Vatican and stuff. That's what, you know, this is a story that Verhoeven always loves to tell, and he's telling it.
He is a fascinating dude.
Yeah.
I have seen, I think, almost every one of his films, including the old Dutch ones,
okay.
Because there was a moment when I was assigned.
Oh, yeah, you were going to interview him, right?
In the early 2000s, I was assigned an interview with him for the release of the film Hollow Man. And I did all the research. I checked out all the old films. I watched them all and became really taken by the level of religious symbolism going on in so many of his movies.
Yeah, Fourth Man.
And how each film, even the ones that aren't overtly, you know, stocked with religious iconography or metaphors, how much of his work is about human wickedness and people, bad people doing bad things to other bad people. And how every single one of them needs salvation. At one point, he wanted to make a film about the life of Christ.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he still wants to, but he hasn't yet.
Netflix, make that movie.
I think that his willingness to straddle the lines of, you know, prurience and exploitation mm-hmm. and, you know, the agency of his characters makes him more and more difficult a director as the years go on. Because back in the day, you could just say, oh, well, Basic Instinct, you know, that was a trashy movie.
Right.
But there's a line that goes from, you know,
Katie Tipple and Spetters.
Spetters and
Fourth Man.
There's a line that goes from there through Basic Instinct, through even Starship Troopers,
oh, sure.
to a film like this. It's a weird line, and it zigs and zags, and it takes you into places that you maybe don't think he's actually taking you, because so often what he does is packaged in a shiny, glossy pop, you know, package.
Genre, yeah. RoboCop is a Christ figure.
Pretty much, yeah. So everything that I saw in this film reminded me of things I've seen in his earlier films. And it reminded me also how much I really dig his willingness to put you right down in the mud with the worst versions of
people.
And yet finding a kind of faster pussycat thrill in it as well. This is a film about faith. This is a film about knowing who you are and getting what you want. But what you want is to be as close to God as possible.
Right.
You know, there was a nun in the 13th century called Agnes Blanbekin.
Okay.
Who had, like, really, really erotic visions of Jesus.
Huh.
And she became pretty, you know, notorious for those. This is a clean podcast. So I won't be, you know, going down the list of all the things that were in her visions. But, you know, you could look her up, and she's an interesting woman. Now, obviously, the visions of Benedetta in this film are not specifically erotic. Some of them are just violent. But they all are part of her sexuality. Mm. And her sexuality is part of her faith. in this film because she loves Bartolomea in a very pure way. That, you know, those squares just couldn't get with. So
I forget the name, but I believe that it was the Visions of a Nun that inspired a lot of, like, Mel Gibson's brand of Catholicism up to and including The Passion of the Christ.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Some, like, German nun from the 19th century or something.
Huh. Well, then.
Yeah.
You know, I love a mystic. Don't know what they're on about, but I think they're cool.
They're keeping the game fresh and exciting.
They really are. So, you know, if you're lucky enough to have people protesting outside your movie theater when you go see this.
Take pictures.
Take some pictures. Tell them to go home. Have a nice day.
Tell them to go feed some hungry people.
That would be a better use of their time, perhaps. What is the last movie we're here to talk about?
Is it The Power of the Dog?
The Power of the Dog. That's right. Thank you for reminding me because I just went blank for a second. If I go blank one more time during the course of this podcast...
We have a bingo.
It'll be, like a tic-tac. Well, more like a tic-tac-toe. The Power of the Dog is the latest film from Jane Campion.
Yes.
And it is based on a novel from 1967 by...
Thomas Savage.
Thomas Savage. Who is a writer that I don't know much about. I know he wrote a lot of Westerns.
Yeah, it's the first time hearing of him.
But I'll tell you, Netflix, it's currently in theaters and on Netflix.
Yes.
And Netflix does not miss a trick this time of year. They send you boxes of stuff.
Yes.
DVD screeners.
Voting critics and voting
score,
guild members.
Compact discs, novels and screenplays. If it's based on a novel, they send you the novel. If it's based on something else, they send you the other source material. If it's an original screenplay, they print up an original screenplay and send it to you. Then they send you a big Asseline coffee table book. Yes. About the film. And if it's Nomadland, they send you a giant box.
Oh, that wasn't Netflix.
It wasn't? Who was that?
That was Fox Searchlight.
Well, Fox Searchlight sent us a giant box of gourmet treats.
But no, Netflix...
Didn't Netflix just send us all the Asghar Farhadi stuff?
No, that was Amazon.
Okay, well...
But Netflix sent
Netflix
sent us the three-wick candle for that...
The Hand of God.
For the Hand of God.
Got a giant three-wick candle. Look, this it's gift day every day in December when the year-end stuff comes on. Because they want you to...
Just so y'all know...
They want to bowl you over with treats, what they want.
My vote cannot be bought, but I do admire the grift that these people are like cranking this stuff out and sending us these massive art books about the making of, you know, The Power of the Dog.
They sent us a copy of the original novel.
Oh, did they?
Netflix did, yes. And now that I've seen this film, I want to read this novel.
Mm.
Because what a strange... Who read this in 1967 and what did they think?
Yeah.
If it's faithful, and I'm guessing it's pretty faithful. It's the story of a pair of brothers, the Burbank brothers.
Yes.
And they are, you know, it's in the year is 1925, and they are out on the plains somewhere. I can't remember now what...
they have a ranch in Montana.
State they're in. It's Montana. Okay. And they are ranchers. One of the brothers, played by Jesse Plemons, is quiet, keeps to himself, runs the business.
Wears a bow tie even when they are, like, you know, herding cattle.
Yes. He is a man of few words. And he is let's say he's just browbeaten by his brother Phil.
Yes. Because everyone is browbeaten by Phil.
Played by Benedict Cumberbatch. Phil is cruel and sadistic and angry and lives disgustingly.
Yeah.
He is a ranch guy and he, at least two or three times, people ask him to bathe and he refuses. And at one point he says, I stink and I like it.
He's... Toxic masculinity in a pair of boots.
Pretty much. But Phil also has a past. He has a past with someone named Bronco Henry.
Yes, his mentor.
And he has a past with an Ivy League education where he studied the classics.
Yes.
That he never talks about, that he pretends never happened. So they come across a woman who runs a restaurant named Rose, just played by Kirsten Dunst. And George, played by Jesse Plemons, he falls in love with Kirsten Dunst. They are really married in real life, by the way. If you didn't know that, they are actually...
They met on Fargo.
They are married with a baby or even two, perhaps, at this point. They're my favorite Hollywood couple.
They're great.
Yeah. I don't necessarily have favorite Hollywood couples, but they are my favorite Hollywood couple. So she has a dog, not a dog. She has a son played by Cody Smit McPhee.
Yes.
He is about 21, around that age. He is shy. He is creative. He is artistic. He is a medical student. He is...
Sensitive.
He is probably gay. Although nothing is ever discussed.
No.
He is, however, treated with horrific homophobic cruelty by
Phil.
As well as all the ranch hands who do everything that Phil tells them to do.
Yes.
Because Phil is the boss of everybody. And they meet Cody Smit McPhee's character. His name is Peter. They meet when Phil is mocking Peter for making paper flowers for the restaurant tables. Sets one on fire, in fact, and dunks it in a pitcher of water. And Pete takes notice of this. And then simmers. For the rest of the film. Along the way, we learn things about Phil that explain him. We also learn some things about ranching that you do need to pay attention to, because they will come into play later on in the final bit that we will not spoil.
No.
Because the ending is deeply satisfying. And if you blink, you could miss it. Because stuff happens and you think, wait, what? Just, it takes you like beat, beat, beat. And then you say, oh, that's what just happened. And even though I could see some revelations coming, I could not see that ending coming. And that makes me very happy.
Yeah.
Jane Campion has a way of pitting her characters against harsh circumstances.
Yes.
Whether they are harsh, you know, harsh eras in history, harsh terrain, harsh life circumstances that befall them, you know, accidents, you name it. She puts her characters into position to sink or swim in these environments. This movie reminded me more of The Piano than most other stuff that she's done. And I don't think it's simply because it's very, you know, period.
Right.
But tonally.
Yeah,
as well.
No, I would say that too. And admittedly, I have not seen, like, I've still never seen Portrait of a Lady.
Well, that's great.
I know. That's what I've heard. I've not seen all of her films. But yeah, that was the one that came to mind for me as well.
I really, really love her films and have since the late 80s, early 90s when I saw Sweetie, which was, I guess, her first or maybe second?
First, she had a made-for-TV feature called Two Friends and then Sweetie.
And I'm a big fan of In the Cut, and I know, like, nobody is, but I still am.
You and April Wolf, at least.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that means April and I are correct.
Ingu, in fact, Ingu Kang did a podcast called All About Almodovar, and now she and her co-host are doing one called All About Campion. And
have they done an episode about In the Cut?
Yeah, and April was on there.
I need to listen to that episode.
Yeah, you should. I did the Angel at My Table episode.
Oh, that's right. You did.
Yes.
So this is my third blank of the podcast. So tic-tac-toe. How do you feel about this movie?
Oh, it's amazing. The performances are all great. This is on my list of movies that I want to see projected sometime.
Yeah.
Because the way that, you know, you think you've seen everything a Western has to say about big sky country
and
the flatness of the American terrain, but boy, Campion really takes us to some new places there, I think. And yeah, I just think this is, there is such a, the mythos of American masculinity doesn't get taken down nearly often enough.
No, not at all.
So I'm glad that it's happening here.
I appreciated so much of the John 40 compositions going on. And I also appreciate that sense of loneliness that happens, not just because you've got one person standing against an immense, you know, backdrop of, you know, sky and land and geography, but Westerns have not dealt with some very specific and contemporary types of loneliness that certainly existed back then, but that no one wrote about or talked about or ultimately made films about. And here is a story from the past that we know happened.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, this isn't a true story, but you know that people like this existed, and they existed for these reasons. And, you know, John Wayne was never going to star in a movie with this as the subject matter.
Right.
And we're being kind of talky aroundy here, but it's because we want you to experience it.
Yeah.
It's painful at times to watch. And it's also, as I said, deeply satisfying at the end, because you've got what becomes an incredibly quiet game of chess that's taking place. And as I said, if you blink, you miss it. So don't be fooled by the fact that this is a contemplative feeling drama.
Sure.
There's stuff going on.
Absolutely. Benedict Cumberbatch, this is...
I hated him so much.
Yes. he really, like, there's never that moment of, like, winking at the audience to let you know that, oh, no, I'm not really this bad. No, no, no. He's taking the plunge.
I don't have a DVD to recommend, because I've got 40 movies that I have to watch for the end of the year.
I'm going to recommend one that I haven't watched yet, but that I'm excited that it exists, and you and I are going to maybe take a look at it over the holidays. There is Paramount Presents, which is a label that they've been doing some of their kind of, you know, interesting, you know, back catalog stuff that they want to spotlight. They recently put out, like, Bugsy Malone. Just did a new release of Milos Forman's Ragtime.
Oh, yeah.
From 1981. And
when you said what we're going to do over the holidays, I was like, speak for yourself. But no, we actually we already did discuss this,
And this includes his work print cut. And apparently, like, Paramount did him dirty on this one, and...
What a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm very excited to see what his original cut was like, because I'm a fan of the book. I remember liking the movie when I saw it. I was like 14 at the time. But I love the rediscovery of a version that we haven't seen before that might make the entire movie, you know, be reexamined in the eyes of the culture. So, yeah, check out the Ragtime Blu-ray. It's out, I think, this coming Tuesday.
Got some letters.
All right.
Yeah. This is from Martin. Listening to your conversation about Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, I found myself in agreement with you. The movie is struggling with its viewpoint. It presents themes that it's not capable of grappling with, largely because it's at odds with Wright's kinetic and slick aesthetic. kinetic aesthetic.
Uh-huh.
This is heavy subject matter that even if handled trashily requires a filmmaker who can go to those places, and I don't think Wright is the man.
Mm.
I've seen arguments that the film should not be expected to handle the subject matter in a more progressive way because it is a pastiche of giallo films. While giallo films are often misogynist, trashy, and exploitative, they succeed through mood and tone. Wright is clearly drawing on these films by pulling in the bloody violence and dazzling colors. Shout out to that one shot from Clouseau's Inferno. What's lacking is the trash and exploitation. Perhaps the bigger budget, as well as Wright's winking style, prevent it from digging down into the inherent nastiness of its premise and subsequent twist, and that plays fast and loose with these ideas. The movie I think of that nails a lot of what Last Night in Soho is going for is Abel Ferrara's Ms. 45. It's not a one-to-one comparison, but deals with sexual assault and the subsequent vigilantism of the victim. It doesn't have any easy answers and is willing to grapple with the raw and upsetting nature of it all. It has the grimy, early 80s New York City aesthetic that immerses the viewer in a world that feels as unhinged as dangerous as the people in it. Last Night in Soho wants to dip its toe into the rape revenge pool. Ms. 45 is doing laps. Ultimately, I think Last Night in Soho would be better if it had been sleazier.
Yeah.
P.S. Dave, did you see that the Blu-ray for Simon Lang's Days has an additional feature film on it? Yes. If I'm not mistaken, it has the documentary Afternoon on it. I could be wrong about that, but that's what I think is on it. Which is great, and it's him and Lee sitting in a room talking. And it's mostly not Lee doing the talking, of course. Scrolling down. Here we go. Julia. The 90s were an absolutely crazy time to grow up in Italy. Between mafia attacks, near financial collapse, and a corruption crisis that landed half of the government in jail. So an insane story like Patrizia Reggiani's really only registered because I grew up in Milan, and like L.A. and movies, there is no existing without bumping into the fashion industry. I do remember Mr. Scott's wife dancing on Italian TV in those years, and I can't help but wonder if she has been consulted about the cultural milieu of rich people circa 1994. I am really baffled by the accent choices, though. Mostly, I'm still wondering, who is this movie for? We're talking about House of Gucci, by the way. While I can see American audiences enjoying, more or less ironically, accents that are recognizable, more or less farcically, as Italian/American to an Italian, this looks like an unfunny parody, and I'm not even sure of what. I think the contrast between the fashion choices that are 100% spot on and the wacky accents was too much for me to take. I was hoping I would find this hilarious the way I found Bill Hader's Italian talk show hilarious.
I forgot about those.
But the whole thing left me a bit sour and bored. And regarding Lady Gaga's accent, my take is that there are so few references for Italian actors speaking English in an authentic and non-Super Mario accent that she went a bit Russian. Mm. Can't blame her, though. People constantly think I'm from somewhere else. I just kept thinking about Marcello Mastroianni in A Place for Lovers when he's yelling at Faye Dunaway,
Julie, I love you!
If you've never seen Marcello Mastroianni and Faye Dunaway in a film called A Place for Lovers, you should!
Oh, man, yeah. Vittorio De Sica in English, not good. But unforgettable.
Sandra says, hey, it's Sandra from Vancouver.
Hey.
I would be remiss not to weigh in on House of Gucci. My heritage is fully one-half Italian, which makes me feel more qualified than most of the cast of this film to comment on the accents. They were crazy and over the top. Even Al Pacino, who is full Italian, is off the chain with whatever it is he's doing. It's interesting that you pointed out Jeremy Irons as doing an elder Dracula, because all of my best friends and I could hear from Adam Driver was doing full-on in his prime Dracula. And as much as Lady Gaga is somewhat Russian-sounding when you mention it, I do believe she pretty much does nail Patrizia Reggiano. Jared Leto, on the other hand, is amazing. Amazingly crazy, and I'm here for it. The takeaway we had about him is once my best friend pointed out that he looks exactly like Dr. Phil. You cannot unsee it. So for both of us, it was more than enough to keep us entertained for the 2.5 hours. I feel bad that you did not find that level of enjoyment on it, Alonzo. Mm-hmm. Perhaps on a second or third watch, it will have that charm for you as well.
That's never happening.
Could be calling it early, but I feel like this could be the next Showgirls. It remains to be seen.
I was shocked to discover that Jared Leto is also currently like the face of Gucci, or a face of Gucci.
I thought that was Adam Driver.
No, I saw an ad with Jared Leto in it.
Oh, really?
I'm like, really? They let you in after you did that?
Maybe they liked it.
Maybe.
Jared, we love you. this is a letter from Houston. Or do I pronounce your name Houston? I'm going to say Houston.
Okay.
I was recently listening to the episode where you discussed Last Night in Soho. I was incredibly happy when Dave touched on the mental illness aspect of the film and talked about how it was used as more of a backdrop to the film and not used in any meaningful way, more so to make Eloise seem, quotes, crazy. I agree 100%, and I really didn't like the movie because of that and other reasons. But it got me thinking about films that handle the topic of mental health really well. I was curious what some films that you have seen that approach the topic respectfully and maturely. And I can't think of it.
All I can think of are bad examples.
You know, I've seen films where people are in therapy, mm-hmm. and there's always a cathartic moment.
Yeah.
When it kind of fixes them.
Sure.
And I don't hate that. I just, it's not accurate. I always go back to The Cobweb.
Oh, my God.
There's a movie from the 50s called The Cobweb.
Vincent Minnelli.
Which is about people who live in a psychiatric hospital. And...
And the staff.
And it is... obviously full of wrong-headed takes from its era. But it's also boring. And here's what I think is valuable about that. Every day of your life, if you are dealing with mental health challenges, is not, a crisis. It's not, some psychedelic mind bend.
Right.
It's boring. Everyday life is boring, and everyone knows this is a fact. And so no matter what, is going on with your mental health, there's a mundane quality to it, and I don't know that I've ever seen a movie that deals with the mundane aspects of this quite like The Cobweb. am I talking out of my butt, or am I kind of right? I see what you're saying.
I mean, right. On the one hand, yes, it's a very sort of Hollywood treatment. But yeah, it is this movie that's mainly about drapes. And so, it does sort of demystify it in a way by just, it's not a constant, like, shrieking violin.
What was that movie, The Snake Pit?
Yes.
Yeah. And that seems to me to be like the well that people like to draw
yeah.
from.
Yeah. For me, most interesting piece of media about mental illness issues, Ellen Forney, a cartoonist, did a book called Marbles.
Yeah.
About her own grapples with bipolar disorder.
Yes.
And the idea that as an artist and as a creative person, she was reticent for a long time to treat it because, Van Gogh and like all these right. examples of like, see, if you if you tamp it down, then you don't get to be
a genius.
Yeah, you quash your talent
right.
or whatever. Yeah,
right.
And it really kind of captures what a manic episode is like and what a depressed episode is like and how she would try and fix it to where I would start these art projects during the manic phase and just leave myself the easy parts to sort of finish off during the depressed phase. And then she'd get to the depressed phase and be like, I can't get off the sofa.
I can't do my work.
Yeah. I found that to be really compelling. If people who have BPD have read it and have issues with it, let me know. But I really like Marbles.
I just can't think of a contemporary film that takes this on as a subject.
I mean, Cronenberg's Spider. But that seems kind of de trop. Like it.
Yeah, I don't know I don't have a good answer for you right now. If anyone has
suggestions
for good films that deal with this subject
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com
in a responsible way that's intelligent and respectful, we would like to know.
Yeah.
And now we're done.
All right.
We have to record another podcast in about 15 minutes.
True. Story of our lives. So, as mentioned, I have a new book out. It's called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. I wrote it with the host of the Deck the Hallmark podcast. It's a nifty gift for people in your life if they like Hallmark movies, if they like to goof on Hallmark movies. It's got reviews of more than 100 of those Hallmark Christmas movies, plus recipes for throwing your own gathering and some real fun first-person essays from the Deck the Hallmark guys, and a bingo card and lots of other cool stuff. Behind-the-scenes insights from actors, writers, and directors of these movies. I'm proud of it, and I hope people check it out, and I hope you like it. You can also hear me on the Breakfast All Day podcast, Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network, and at least weekly or so on Deck the Hallmark as well. So please give those a listen. Check us out on Apple Podcasts. Feel free to leave us a 5-star review, and we will read it on the show, like this one from Wombat929, who writes, "Reminding me of the joy of cinema. I used to watch all kinds of movies, and then I had kids and got into a suburban rut and drifted away from the more interesting films I used to pursue. I came to Linoleum Knife because I also listened to Maximum Film and wanted to hear more from Alonzo, and what I found here is a delight. Dave brings a gravitas and a gravelly voice that compliments Alonzo very well, and in listening to the show, I'm reminded what it was like to gather with friends after a night out at the movies to talk through what we'd seen. Thanks for bringing me back to the fold, gents." Well, thank you, Wombat929.
I appreciate it. I have gravitas.
You do. Gravitas and
makes gravel. You want to treat me with a little more respect, doesn't it?
Don't get crazy.
Are you telling me that that you don't...
respect your gravitas?
My gravitas?
Your authorita?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Fine. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Apple Music, Google Play, CastBox, and Podbean. Drop us a line, like we said, at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Check out what his latest stuff, including his new album, Six Tape, at blueBLEU.bandcamp.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next time with more. And until then,
goodbye.